I think it actually had a lot to do with when my daughter was born. So my daughter was born in August of 2020 at Strong Hospital. And as I'm wheeling my wife into the hospital and she's in labor, doctors and nurses keep coming up to me and thanking me for the hand sanitizer that we had made earlier that spring for them. And it was sort of, I mean, having a child is a very emotional thing anyway. But, and so I think it was sort of in that moment of clarity that we were an impact on our community in a positive way, in a major way, that really finally had me take my head up, you know, above the day-to-day long enough to notice really. Because I mean, for 10 years, we've just been grinding, you know, it's, you know, every day, what's the hurdle? How do we get over that hurdle? How do we move, you know, the ball forward 2 inches? You know, the distilling game is a game of inches. You don't tend to get these major epiphany pieces. You're just pushing all these balls slowly uphill. So I think it was in that moment and having a little bit of time to reflect on what the team had accomplished both that year and the 10 years that really made me realize. But the plant is built for 1,000 bottles a day. 3 weeks after we started the hand sanitizer project, we were making 17,000 bottles of hand sanitizer.
You're listening to the Real Business Connections Network.
Real Business Connections Network.
Powered by Balbert Marketing, LLC. Subscribe now and check us out at realbusinessconnections.com. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to Rochester Business Connections, powered by Balbert Marketing, LLC, where I get the chance to chat with Rochester, New York's very best business owners, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders. I am your host, Ben Albert. Don't forget to subscribe, and remember, we don't do advertisements. My fee for this show is simple. If you gain value from the episode, personally share with a friend and explain your favorite part. Let's get started. Welcome, everyone, to Rochester Business Connections on the Real Business Connections Network. I am here today with Jason Barrett. Jason, what's up, man? How are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me, Ben.
Dude, I'm excited. As we can see, anyone watching the video, I know a lot of people listen to the audio, but anyone watching the video, we got the black button distilling barrels behind Jason here. You are a master distiller and the president at Black Button, right?
Yes, sir.
And I'll be honest. I mean, I'm a health guy, but I love my bourbon. I love my whiskey. And this is coming from me. No one asked me to say this. Best distillery in the Rochester region, the whole area. And let's talk it about, if anyone's still under that rock and they haven't heard of Black Button, give us like a 10,000 foot view of what you do at Black Button Distillery.
Yeah. So we're a New York farm distillery. So we have all of our grains grown for us down in the Geneseo area on one family farm. We bring them to our Rochester distillery. We're going to mash, ferment, distill, age, and bottle the whole process all at one site. So we're completely in control of all the quality from when the grain goes into the ground all the way to that bottle getting poured for our customer. So we make bourbon, we make vodka, we make gin, all from some of the finest New York grown ingredients around.
And it tastes good. It's local here in Rochester, as you just said. But you're more than just local. You guys are winning awards all across the state and the nation, right? Tell us a little bit about some of the prestige you've guys taken in the past, you know, 10 years here.
Yeah, I think it might surprise folks to learn we actually distribute in 14 states. We export to Japan. Wow. We're in negotiations to start exporting to Israel. And we've made over 2 million bottles in the last 10 years. So, you know, we just took home a double gold at the San Francisco International Spirit Competition for one of our bourbon blends. And actually our single barrel took best bourbon in the nation at Heartland Spirit Competition, which is run by the New York Corn Growers, or sorry, U.S. Corn Growers. So if anybody knows bourbon, it's farmers that grow corn.
And you guys are celebrating 10 years. So Jason and I joked about this beforehand. We're recording before the official anniversary. I'm pre-recording. I'm about to go to New Orleans on vacation. Just Ben's just having fun. But basically June is 10 years, right? So this is coming out at the end of June.
Yeah.
June is 10 years. Walk me through, you know, the celebration of the 10 years or just anything you're excited about being in business 10 years, man.
Yeah, I mean, it's just been a great adventure. We're going to have a nice big event at the distillery there the first week of June. We're going to be releasing the oldest whiskey we've ever put out, a 3-barrel blend of 7-year-old 53-gallon barrels. The first time we're releasing the large format barrels. We've usually been using mid-size barrels. We worked with a local woodworker to craft these really neat like wooden cases. So the first 100 bottles of that release, available only in the tasting room, come in that wooden case that not only celebrates 10 years of the distillery, but actually 100 years of my family being involved in button making here in Rochester. So they're a really neat piece. We're super proud of the whiskey that's in the bottle and super proud of the local packaging connection. Again, having crafted those pieces down in the Bristol Valley. So, you know, it's just great to see the staff coming together. You know, we've had people with us 5, 6, 7 years. I'm sure a lot of our original staff, the folks that were with us in the early years, will come back to celebrate with us as they often do. And it'll just be great, especially after 2 years of lockdowns and everything, be able to have the distillery full of happy people enjoying whiskey once again, you know, in their community. So it's going to be a great set of events, and it's a great milestone, and hopefully the first of many decades that we are celebrating.
Yeah, and listen, anyone listening, we could be listening to this in 2025. That's the beauty of a podcast, right? You in 2025 and 2030 and 2035. I mean, you got big visions. Like, here's to 10 more. First off, here's to 10 more.
Oh, certainly.
And what are some of your big visions for the future? I know you're always future planning. So what's coming in the next 5 to 10 years?
So, I mean, distilleries are really kind of a unique business. Not only is there a pretty high barrier to entry in terms of regulatory and processing and everything, but then our main product is bourbon, and bourbon has to age for many years. And so we started out with smaller barrels, aging for about 2 years. Right now, our standard is the mid-size barrels, aging about 4 years. But we're actually making product in the large format, 53-gallon barrels, for 2030 through 2032. So we have to plan a full 10 years in advance and really try to estimate that demand and where things are going. And, and the only known thing is that we probably won't guess right, but we make as much as we can afford to, and hopefully that's enough to satisfy demand, or just under enough to satisfy demand that far out. More whiskey's coming. We do have plans to expand the plant, bring on additional equipment and produce, you know, distillers. We're just cranking back up from a bit of a slowdown with COVID. But the sky's the limit. I would say we will double or triple again in our next 10 years.
Sky's the limit. Going to double, triple, more whiskey, more bourbon coming our way. You guys don't just distill whiskey though, right? Tell me a little bit about some of the other products if someone's not a whiskey drinker.
Yeah, so we have quite a selection of gins. Both myself and Jeff Fairbrother, my business partner, are UK Warden Rectifiers, which is the British equivalent of being a master distiller, which we've also got those certifications. The nice part about gin is that you can innovate and, you know, make it today, sell it tomorrow. So it's just a very different R&D cycle where you can take a lot more risks. So we've got our citrus forward gin, which is great for summer, a little light on the juniper. You know, great for cocktails that involve any kind of fruit or floral note. We've got our American dry gin, which is more of your classic martini style gin. Then we do a lilac gin for the Lilac Festival, comes out every May. So very floral, very light. We have to hand pick all of the lilac petals. So we only make about 5,000 bottles a year, and it's all pre-order. So that sells out quite quickly. For the Buffalo area, we do a Loganberry gin. So Loganberries are a cross between blackberries and raspberries. And distilling with that fresh fruit just really brings some great unique flavors Again, great for an aviation or a French 75. And then we're always coming out with kind of one-off, interesting, quirky little products to keep the guys, stretching that innovation muscle. And oftentimes you'll see us partnering with others in the community for that special release.
Yes, and I'll tell everyone at home, ultimately, the Lilac Gin is out now at the time you're listening to this. You need to go get it, because if you're in Greece, I'm pretty sure my girlfriend's already bought them all, so there's a short timetable that you... My girlfriend loves the Lilac Gin. That's all she'll drink for 3 months from, like, June until September. So,
yeah.
Ultimately, guys, you need to go and get the Lilac Gin. I recommend it. My girlfriend loves it. And the flavors year round, like you said, you get to take a little bit of risks with gin. Bourbon's a little bit more of a longer process. I want to kind of pivot to something completely different, because I didn't want to pivot yet, because I wanted to kind of dive into the history and the flavors. But you had mentioned that your family has had a Budden factory in Rochester for, was it 100 years, you said?
Yeah. So so if you're familiar with where Monroe Ave meets 490, the 5-story building behind the gas station there that's now called Button Lofts. Hmm. If you'd gone in there in 1922, you would have met my great grandfather. He started out sweeping the floors. And by the Depression, he was the shop foreman. And then my grandfather came back from Korea to work for his father for one summer. Well, in the 80s, he had bought out the rest of the partners. So as people would retire, my grandfather would buy their shares. And then by 96, my mom had joined, and she actually still runs the Button Company today, but it's actually where we get our name from. So I'm colorblind. So the joke when I was a kid was that if I took over the factory, we'd only be able to make black buttons. So now I make black buttons, but of the liquid variety instead.
I love that. I did not know that. It's fascinating. Walk me through, because obviously long-standing family-owned company, walk me through when you decided that you were going to start a distillery rather than, continue with the Budden factory. Were your family upset? What was going on? Like, what was that?
So I was actually never on a path to run the Budden factory. I mean, really, my eyesight makes it not possible. We have 1,000 shades of red, 1,000 shades of green, 1,000 shades of blue. And I can tell you that blue 100 and blue 900 are different, but you need to be able to see those variations. And it's just not practical to be in that line of work with my lack of eyesight. So I actually didn't even intend to go into business. I studied political science in college. I moved to Washington, D.C. and actually clerked on Capitol Hill for a congressman. I wanted to be Josh Lyman from The West Wing, not the politician, but the guy behind the guy making the policy happen. Mm. And unfortunately, I found out that the TV show and reality had little to do with each other. And this was before politics got nearly as divisive as it is today.
Right.
So I had minored in accounting just because it seemed like a good baseline thing to have. And so when I decided to leave politics, I ended up getting a job with Paychex, the payroll company headquartered here in Rochester, down in their DC office, thanks in part to that minor in accounting. And I ended up in their small business division, where I got to work with all these entrepreneurs that were running all these small businesses, restaurants, breweries, morgues, lawn care companies. And after a few years of that, I started to realize that this was something I thought I could be really good at, that I really had an interest in. And I was young enough in my life that if it didn't go well, there was probably still time to recover. I mean, I was 24 years old. I didn't have a wife or a kid. I sold my house. And I moved back to Rochester after having written the business plan for Black Button. So originally, actually, I was thinking about opening a brewery. But as I was doing my market research, there were already 7 breweries in the county. We now have 40, so there was clearly more room to grow. But yeah, at the time, being number 8 seemed a little strange.
And we'll talk about that in a minute, Jason, how breweries and distilleries, Rochester is a great place to open one up. We'll get into that in a second.
It really is. Yeah. So I actually almost bought a brewery down in North Carolina. My life almost took a very interesting turn. But the economics of that business didn't really work. But the owner happened to mention that he originally planned to be a brewery slash distillery. And so I started researching distilleries to try to see if adding that would make that business viable. Ultimately, I didn't end up buying that brewery, thankfully, but realized that for the amount of capital I had, starting a distillery actually made more sense from a startup perspective. What I left out of that is the ongoing capital requirements to lay down all this whiskey. Mm-hmm. So you don't know what you don't know, but I'm glad I decided to go into the distilling path and made that choice. And Rochester's a great place to do it. We've got great agriculture, great people, great industrial space, and a really supportive community.
So you decide to go the distilling path. You've got the business plan. You move back to Rochester. Is there 1,000 people at the door ready to buy your whiskey? Or tell me about that starting phase. It probably wasn't as easy as we want it to be.
No, so it took 18 months to get the license. We have to be federally and state regulated. We melted the cooling pipes on the still during the first run. So we were hand packing ice into the cooling column all night. It took 40 hours and I stayed up 40 hours straight. The problem was we had already announced that we were launching. It was the Saturday before Christmas and we had already put on Facebook that we were going to open. So there was no choice but to finish. And it was interesting that the day we opened, I unlock the door and there's nobody there. And here, I've planned this huge, I've got 6 cash registers, like something like 10,000 people RSVP'd on Facebook. And I open the door and there's no one there. And it's only because they were all sitting in their car. As soon as I opened the door, they all got out and we had a line for hours.
Okay.
But that initial moment of opening the door and there's no one waiting, like my heart just sank. And 5 minutes later, it was fine. But yeah, we opened the Saturday before Christmas of 2013 with just vodka. We'd only made one run. We closed for about a month, made our vodka, our citrus forward gin, and our moonshine, reopened to the public January 25th, 2013. And have been rocking and rolling ever since.
Rocking and rolling since. So tell me, and it could be a moment or a series of moments. Was there a time where you're like, deep breath, and you're like, wow, I actually think we're onto something here. Like, I actually think we made it. Because, day one, you look outside and no one's there at all. And granted, it was almost like a trick on you. It was that's hilarious. I feel for you here. Was there a moment where you realized that you were really onto something big, that led into this massive expansion you're going through now?
So it's interesting. I think it actually had a lot to do with when my daughter was born. So my daughter was born in August of 2020, at Strong Hospital. And as I'm wheeling my wife into the hospital, and she's in labor, doctors and nurses keep coming up to me and thanking me for the hand sanitizer that we had made earlier that spring for them. And it was sort of, having a child is a very emotional thing anyway, so I think it was sort of in that moment of clarity that we were an impact on our community in a positive way and a major way, that really finally had me take my head up, above the day-to-day long enough to notice really. Because for 10 years, we've just been grinding, it's, every day, what's the hurdle? How do we get over that hurdle? How do we move, the ball forward 2 inches? The distilling game is a game of inches. You don't tend to get these major epiphany pieces. You're just pushing all these balls slowly uphill. So I think it was in that moment and having a little bit of time to reflect on what the team had accomplished both that year and the 10 years that really made me realize. But the plant is built for 1,000 bottles a day. 3 weeks after we started the hand sanitizer project, we were making 17,000 bottles of hand sanitizer a day. So that was really just kind of the eye-opening moment that we had, that we were a success. And I also try to not let that go to my head. We still have to keep a focus on the day-to-day and what we need to do.
It's a stepping stone, but it's not the end-all be-all. And that's just, walk me through that, because obviously COVID stunk, but you guys, that's a big pivot. It is the kind of equipment you use to distill the kind of equipment you use to make hand sanitizer, or was that a completely different process?
So not normally, but the FDA issued an emergency authorization that basically said, if you can take vodka, sterile water, vegetable glycerin, which is basically a thickener in salad dressing, and hydrogen peroxide, you follow this exact 11-page recipe, bottle it exactly this way, label it exactly this way, it is emergency hand sanitizer. Because the usage rate, I mean, I think people don't realize the usage rate change from January to April of 2020. It was something like 110,000% change. So obviously the existing hand sanitizer industry, you know, you can put on a second shift, you can put on a third shift, but nobody's reaching that. And there was a dire need for it at that time. So that's why the FDA tapped the distillers. And it was interesting. Everybody had to approach it their own way. There were many great distillers that gave their time, gave equipment, worked for free and donated small quantities to their local fire department, hospital, police department. We very quickly saw that the need was massive and that in order to respond in a massive way, we needed to build a sustainable model.
Right.
So we talked to Strong Hospital. We said, hey, what did you pay for hand sanitizer prior to COVID? And they told us, and it worked out to what our pricing was. So even though they were now paying two or three or four times that, our goal in here really was to keep our employees working, to help pay our rent, and to serve our community. And I mean, we ended up responding with 435,000 bottles, which is 329 million hand washes. So literally every person in the country could have washed their hands once with what we delivered. And most of that was just here in upstate or going down to New York City. So we feel like we did our part, and it was important that we kept our people working. Because I mean, these are people I've worked side by side with for years. And most people are not in a position where, you know, taking 3 to 4 months off unplanned, unpaid, you know, it would just not be sustainable for them. So we went from furloughing everyone to calling everyone back to working overtime for the whole summer. And again, actually, the young man we were talking about before we hopped on, that's where he earned the down payment for his house, was working overtime during COVID. And luckily, we had enough inventory of our spirits in the warehouse that we were able to keep that side of the business going while most of the team focused on hand sanitizer.
This is powerful. I hear these big numbers in my brain just like exploding. Like how big is your space there? How big is the production
space? We have 5,000 square feet, but 1,400 of it is the tasting room. I mean, we were using the parking lot. We were using Wegmans was kind enough to let us borrow a couple of tractor trailers. It is amazing how the both government and business community can come together during a time of crisis. I mean, we literally Wegmans ended up being our retail distribution partner. We did not feel we could hand the hand sanitizer out through Railroad Street, and we couldn't have a mob of people. So we worked with them. And when we told them, listen, you know, in order to increase capacity to meet your needs, we need two tractor trailers for storage. We need to borrow a couple of pallet jacks. We need this, this, and this. And they were like, okay, it'll all be there tomorrow. Mm. Because they saw the need, had that infrastructure, could help. The city changed parking regulations. The post office gave us our own stamp at one point so we could mail boxes to any post office in the United States for a flat $5. The bank raised our credit limit so we could buy the materials to do all of this. I mean, it was an incredible time where it felt like, you know, if it needed to be done and it was related to this, they would make it happen. And we did. So, and again, it was a lot of people working very hard in a very difficult time. I mean, these are people coming to work 6 days a week, 10 hours a day on a split shift, not knowing whether they're putting themselves in danger, their families in danger. We don't really know how this thing spreads or how it affects people. I mean, there was a lot of fear, and people, you know, had to put that aside for, you know, their personal fears aside for the greater community. And it was really powerful to watch that. I mean, again, these bottling crews, we have two mid 20 assistant distillers. These guys are cleaning the tanks, mopping the floors, you know, prepping the brew. It's the entry level position, but the two young men that do that for us, very powerful, very hardworking. And we basically sat down and we're like, listen, this is what we need you to do. We need you to do it safely. We need you to do it consistently. We need you to lead a team of 10 people older than you that have no bottling experience with highly flammable liquid that has been improvised to make this work. And if you need any support, we are there for you. But you also need to figure a lot of it out, because in order to make this work, I have to do the logistics. The head distiller has to do the batching, and we're all going to be working our asses off until such time as we probably all get furloughed. So how much can we make? How many overtime, and, you know, we were paying production bonuses. How much money can we stuff into your pockets before this all goes away and we're probably all out of work? Because we just didn't know what the world had coming. And it was really powerful. You know, we were fortunate in June of that year. We had some weeks go really, really well. And we decided to pay out significant bonuses to the team. So by Saturday, where they were earning time and a half, they were actually earning triple time. And again, after 15 weeks, they had more than earned it. And at the same time, we tried to set up a structure that didn't take them over, so that there's a reason they were 10-hour shifts, not 12. There's a reason it was 6 days a week, not seven. So though we probably could have made more, I didn't feel that we could do those things safely. We were already asking a lot of people, and they were empowered if their team couldn't. You know, some of the Saturday nights, we didn't get all 10 hours because at 7 or 8, you know, after working, you know, 60-hour weeks, they just said, listen, we got to call it. Otherwise, somebody's going to get hurt. And they always had our support in that. So I think that built a lot of trust between us and our team.
Jason, incredible story. I commend you and your team for the diligence, the hard work, the resilience. Lots of thank you. So first off, thank you goes out to the Rochester business community as a whole for making all that possible. Thank you goes out to you and your team for just crushing it and just defeating all odds. And it's an incredible story, man. And, you know, thank you goes out to you for your leadership in all this. And it's like that story you told, you know, of someone buying their house with this extra income. You know, we locally get to reap rewards, and you're employing local people here in Rochester. Talk a little bit. I know you're really passionate about Rochester, and your family's passionate about Rochester. Is Rochester a dying city? Should I go somewhere else to start a business? I already kind of know the answers to these, but I want to hear from you, your opinion on Rochester as a whole. And if I'm looking to start a business, should I do it?
I definitely think that that if folks have a good, solid plan, there's no better place than Rochester to start a business. I have had the pleasure of living up and down the East Coast in a number of major cities in those years prior to, you know, between college and starting Black Button. And what you find is that it is just so expensive to survive, both the cost of housing, the cost of food, the time in the commute. All of those things, you know, rob you of resources that make it harder to succeed. And in Rochester, where you can get, you know, very cost-effective industrial or office space, you have a very talented, passionate workforce that whose salaries expectations are in line with the cost of housing here. You have access to major markets through, you know, quick flights down to New York, down to Boston. There really is no better place to raise a family, start a business, or in my opinion, live in Rochester. Because also we have a little bit of everything. We've got the Red Wings. We've got the Amherst. We get the off-Broadway plays, you know, a little bit later, but you can really enjoy them. You can go down into the Finger Lakes and enjoy the beautiful scenery, or, you know, over to Niagara Falls if you want an international flair. So we've got a little bit of everything, as well as just a great, great cost of living and cost of manufacturing because of those real estate and salary costs. So I really do think there's no better place I obviously, starting a business is always a major decision, and folks really want to write a great business plan, line up the correct financing, make sure they're ready and have either developed or acquired the skills necessary for that. But I also would say, I think people tend to regret the things they didn't do more than the things they did do. And I think you'll find a lot of passionate entrepreneurs in the Rochester area that want to help people succeed. So if they're looking for help either in creating that business plan, or you know, they're in trouble and they need some help, I think the Rochester business community is always ready to step up and do what they can from an advice and direction standpoint.
Dude, I couldn't agree more. I've got nothing to add. You said it perfectly. I'm wondering, with all these incredible things to do here in Rochester and the surrounding area, you're a workaholic, you're a hard worker, you're a grinder, but you take time off. What is your perfect weekend off? Where can we find you on, like, just a couple days off or just a relaxing day where you don't have to work?
So the irony is that for me, time off actually is more work. But it's a different kind of work. Yes. I have 19 acres on the backside of Bristol Mountain where I'm growing 5,000 juniper bushes and a couple thousand white oak trees. And for me, pretty much any chance I get, I'm out at the farm on my tractor, either splitting wood or shoring up the creek banks or again, you know, watering and tending the trees. So it's weird because it is work, but it's so different than what I normally do. I get to do it alone. I'm not leading or managing any people. And there's a connection with nature, you know, watching, you know, these little seedlings that we put in, you know, now being, you know, maybe knee high and starting to produce fruit. And the fact that it's a 5, 6, 7 year journey, that also, again, has its setbacks. You know, you'll come along and one of the trees got eaten by a deer, and all that work and all that time is just gone. And that's just part of the process. And every spring you plant 1,000 more and the hopes that, you know, enough of them survived that we can make this work. So that's what I tend to do on the weekends, especially in the warmer time. The rest of the time you'll find me hanging out with my wife and my daughter. I like to cook. I like to hang out with family, obviously have a good drink. So we often have folks over, you know, for dinner and bourbon and playing with the kids. So, you know, and again, I mean, whether that's going on a hike here in the Naples or Canandaigua area, enjoying a great restaurant. I mean, there's just a lot of good quality life around here in Rochester.
Yeah. There's nothing better than just some good time with family and friends, maybe get some food, maybe get some bourbon on ice. And just relax. You don't have to be chugging the whole bottle. I'm thinking, like, so you run a distillery, but clearly you don't binge drink every day, because then it would just be completely impossible, because the amount of work ethic you have is just a testament, man. It's incredible.
It's definitely a quality over quantity thing at this point. I actually find I drink a lot less now that I'm in this industry. Obviously, I drink plenty of my own stuff.
Yeah.
But also you just end up with the access and the connections to bring really great whiskey. I also have kind of a kick for vintage whiskey. So meaning things made prior, bourbon made prior to 1986. So back then the stills weren't computer controlled. The equipment wasn't as refined and the wood that they were using was all old growth timber. So there's a richness and a fullness in pre-1986 whiskey you just don't find in modern whiskey. And so finding those dusty bottles, you know, usually at estate sales or other things, if they haven't been opened, it's like peering back in time, because in that glass, they are still the same as the day they were made. And it's really an incredible opportunity to taste what has come before us and to see what it may look like. You know, what do they say 50 years from now? Mm-hmm. About the whiskey we're making. That'll be interesting to see.
Oh, yeah. What are they going to say 50 years from now? That's fascinating. I can't remember the name, so it'll come to me and I'll let you know and maybe add it to the show notes after. But last time I was in Nashville, we went to a distillery and they were using a recipe from the early 1900s.
Yep.
For their current, and they, I swear this guy was like an actor or something. He walked us through a 45-minute presentation, walking through the history, having a sip. We can't drink water in between because it ruins the palate. He wants a nice it was a whole thing. And man, I'm on a tangent, but I'll get you to the name of that place, because if you're ever down south towards Nashville, it was incredible. Incredible.
Was it right downtown?
It was downtown, and I think they have a couple of tasting rooms.
I'd say either Corsair or Old Dominion.
Old Dominion.
Yep.
That's what it
was. So I know Alex, the distiller there, she does a great job. And again, I mean, all over the country, there are folks bringing back, you know, recipes, knowledge, and experience from either pre-prohibition or from family legacies. We're probably one of the few places where, as far as I know, none of my long ago relatives were directly involved in the manufacturing of whiskey. So we had to learn our stuff from scratch. But I went to a number of distilling schools and got my master distilling certificate before jumping into it. But there's a lot of neat stuff. I mean, the Prohibition era coupled with World War II and then Korea really decimated two generations of the distilling industry. Mm. And a lot of information and knowledge was lost that is even just now being brought back. I mean, you go back 10 years, we were the 21st distillery to open in the New York State since 1933. So in almost 80 years, there were only 21 that had ever opened. Only like 8 were operating when we opened. And now there's over 200 distilleries in New York 10 years later. So it's great to see that movement and a lot of folks bringing interesting things back to the market.
Dude, you're keeping Rochester on the map, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Let's go rapid fire. These are short, sweet, either or, fill in the blank questions, just to get to know you on a personal level a little bit more. And we'll start with coffee or tea.
Definitely tea. I don't drink coffee.
Any cats or dogs or furry animals of any kind you love?
So we don't currently have pets. I did not grow up with pets, but I have an 18-month-old daughter, and I now actually understand the whole unconditional love thing, because there's nothing like a child, you know, snuggling you. So I have a feeling if she ends up really wanting a dog, my wife and I may not have the willpower to prevent that.
She'll get what she wants.
I have a feeling it's in our future. Now, the irony, the baby has like a baby tablet. And there's basically a Tamagotchi thing on there. And in order to keep it alive, you have to play these mini games to earn money to buy food and clothing and everything. And so at night, my wife ends up playing the mini games to keep this thing alive, because the baby gets upset if the thing dies. And I'm like, wait a minute. So you're walking the dog, you're feeding the dog. Like, what's happening here?
So, that's coming. It's coming.
It is.
So, this is a tough one. Take your time unless you already have the answer. But of all the brews you guys have done, of all the whiskey you've distilled, the gin, the vodka, do you personally have a favorite?
So our port finish cask strength single barrel is sort of my Mona Lisa. You know, on a cold winter night next to a fireplace, that's where you'll find me drinking. I'm definitely a bourbon guy at heart. I appreciate gin. I like gin in the summer, but there's no doubt the gin was to help us survive while we were waiting for the whiskey to age. Mm. And the whiskey is my one true alcoholic love. But we do bourbon in a number of different variations. So
if I were to go to a local liquor store, and you guys are pretty much everywhere, what's the most popular product if I want to get started?
So the most popular products actually are bourbon cream. So it's kind of like an Irish cream, but made with bourbon. So the flavor is a little bit more intense and a little bit higher level. That's by far our all-star. We outsell Bailey's in 9 out of the top 10 liquor stores here in the Rochester area.
Wow. Leaving Bailey's in the dust, man.
Yeah. Put it in your coffee, drink it, you know, at night on the rocks, put it over ice cream. We bake it in cheesecake with Cheesy Eddies. Like, there's a lot of good things that come out of our bourbon cream.
I like the Cheesy Eddie's idea. Mm. Okay, we'll do one more. What are you learning right now? What's getting you out of bed in the morning?
I mean, right now we're really trying to transit. You know, at first I was doing everything in the company, and then I was leading those that were doing everything in the company. And now I'm leading those that are leading the folks doing everything in the company.
Right.
And that is a level of just management and communication that, that we're still working on, you know, with people going to hybrid work. So we're not all in the same place. We really have to just figure out how to communicate better and better. And there's just a lot going on at Black Button. So we're still tightening up those communication processes and trying to make it more efficient. And then, yeah, just trying to manage the growth. Cause again, you know, there's things that, you know, when we had 4 sales reps, for them to email accounting, for the bottles they were using for sampling wasn't a big deal. We now have 11, and accounting is sort of like, we're losing our minds. They're emailing us all the time.
Right.
So now we got to build a Google sheet and teach everybody how to use it. And that way accounting goes from maybe 100 emails a month to just dealing with one spreadsheet at the end of the month. But all of that just takes a lot of time to dig into the processes and make it all better. So,
dude, keep up the good work. I believe in you. I appreciate you taking the time. Rochester loves you. Ultimately, I appreciate you taking the time. You've got like a million bottles to fill, so I will let you go. Tell us one more time. If people want to reach out to you, Black Button, you're in pretty much all the liquor stores, but
yep.
What action steps should I take to kind of stay up to date on what's new?
Yeah, I mean, the best is if people go to our website, blackbuttondistilling.com, and they sign up for our email list. We only send out maybe 1 or 2 a month, but it's always chock full of classes, events, cocktail recipes, you know, whatever we're doing around the distillery. Obviously, following us on social media, whether it's Facebook or Instagram, gives you a bit of an insight, day of the life of a distiller. Get to see what we're doing. But our email is right on our website. It's just cheers@blackbuttondistilling.com. If people have questions or if there's something we can help with, that's always the easiest way to get in touch with us. But yeah, just head to our website and go from there.
Love it. And I'm not on the newsletter. That's literally what I'm about to do right now, sign up for the newsletter. The moment Lilac Gin comes out, it's going to be sold out because my girlfriend and I are going to buy it all. So make sure everyone else is subscribed to that newsletter as well so you can stay up to date on those kind of updates. Jason, man, it's been a pleasure. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for having me, Ben. Look forward to the next time.
Thanks for listening to Rochester Business Connections. Don't forget to share this, rate, and comment on your favorite platform. You can also email me, ben@valbertmarketing.com. Let's connect soon. Until then, keep thriving, everyone.